I honestly think psychologically there's a bit of a mess there, and I think it comes from before what we're talking about with Real Madrid.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Daily.
Now you're very welcome back to Off the Ball. Kathleen McNamee here with you until 7 o'clock this evening. It's been a brilliant stack show so far for our Nulig Naman special. We had Jesse Barr and Cliona Foley earlier for our Sunday paper review. We had Nicole Turner in just there chatting about her recent retirement announcement. You can get all those podcasts back as well on the Off the Ball app or wherever you normally get your podcasts. A couple of score updates to go through in the FA Cup. It is halftime between Arsenal and Manchester United, nil all between the two of them, although some worrying scenes for Arsenal fans with Gabriel Jesus being stretchered off just before halftime, looking quite distraught. Seemed to be, I think, a knee issue there. Ipswich are 3-0 up against Bristol Rovers. Crystal Palace are 1-0 up against Stockport. It's also halftime between Newcastle and Bromley. It's 1-1 there. Bromley went ahead through Lewis Miley after 16 minutes. Or sorry, through Cameron Cosgrove after 8 minutes. And then Lewis Miley scored for Newcastle after 16 minutes to bring them level. In the earlier results of the day, Tottenham had a bit of trouble getting past Tamworth. That game went to extra time, but they eventually managed to win 3-0. And we also had Doncaster taking on Hull City earlier as well. In the Women's FA Cup, we have a couple of results. Manchester City saw off Ipswich Town 3-0. Newcastle beat Nottingham Forest 1-0. London City Lionesses, with their nice big Irish contingent, they beat Fulham 5-0. And then Sunderland had a big result against Exeter City. They won 7-1. Coming up very shortly, we will have our panel, which will look ahead to the landscape of women's sport in 2025. But first, here is a clip with Tammy and Nat join Nathan Murphy on the Settle In series, sponsored by Guinness, where the pair talked about making the journey from Vietnam to Ireland and what that meant for their family.
My mom was fully convinced that she will never see me again. The first time I've ever seen anybody that's outside of non-Asian was stepping into the airport.
Or was this was just normal? This is what everyone around you was going through?
No, we've never even met a white skinned person before. The first time I've ever seen anybody that's outside of non-Asian was stepping into the airport. And I was like, what the hell is it? Like, what's going on here, you know? And that, we don't know anything. The first time I've ever been on an airplane or seen an airplane, or if I ever heard of an airplane, was in a book.
Okay. So you and your dad came first.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've spoken about it since, when you look back in that time, did he talk to you about why you were going to leave Vietnam, why you were going to leave the rest
really
of the family behind?
I briefly remember my mom just says, you're going to another place, this will be better for your life, just go. My mom was fully convinced that she will never see me again. Mm-hmm. She said that. She was fully convinced that she will never see me again, because back then you didn't have internet. How are you going to communicate? She was expecting that she will never see me again. I don't know why she thought that. But she moved. She said, just go, you look after your dad, your dad will look after you, you will have the best life.
When you and your dad are here, did you have much contact with Vietnam?
No. I would send her letters.
Okay.
I don't know if she received them or not. I think I wrote a letter like nearly every day, even. Think about it now, Jesus. Sorry. But it was like, I just missed her so much. Like,
of course.
But you can't talk to her. You can't ring her.
Can't FaceTime.
It's
not as easy, right?
It's just by memory. Now thinking it back, I'm like, oh my God, how did I even get through this, boss? Sorry, I'm starting back there again, boss. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't even imagine, firstly, that heartbreak of leaving your mother, but then coming to literally a whole new world, as you say, you haven't seen a white person before, and suddenly you're where? Straight to Cavan.
Yeah, like we were... Everything was just very a vivid memory of a blur, but I just remember just pure sadness. That was it.
That was absolutely brilliant chat there with Nat and Tam, which is available on YouTube and also across anywhere that you get your podcast. I really, really recommend listening to it. They were incredibly honest, and it's strange to think that, you know, they had no English when they first came to Ireland and went on to compete and represent the country at the highest level. So an incredible story that is well worth your time once you finish listening here, of course. We want you for the rest of the evening. I'm delighted now to say that I am joined by Maeve De Burka, former Ireland international, and Dublin's Aisling Mar, to look at the landscape of women's sport in 2025. It's a massive year with integration for the GAA. We have where does football go next now that the women haven't qualified for the Euros? And then, of course, the Rugby World Cup coming up later on in the year at a time when Irish rugby is seeing a bit of a revival on the women's side of things. So to look at that and everything in between, it's very nice to have both of you on. Guys, how are we doing?
All good. Thanks.
Yeah, keeping well. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
I suppose before we look ahead to 2025, it'd be nice to look back on 2024, the year that was. I mean, the Olympics, the Paralympics. I just had Nicole Turner in here who competed at the Paralympics. It gave us such a great opportunity to talk about women and women's sport in a way that you don't get every year, because you're seeing people compete on this massive international stage. We saw with the relay team how much they inspired the nation. We have Mona McSharry on a little bit later, her bronze medal. I cried whenever she got that. You know, we had all these great moments. And then all the stuff that was happening within this normal sporting landscape that we have every year was also really interesting. For you, Maeve, what was the highlight of 2024?
Yeah, I think going back there, just to, I suppose I'd love to say Camogie or GAA or the LGFA, but unfortunately Galway lost both finals. So I don't think they'd be my favourite moments, although they're definitely really pivotal, I think, in 2024. They really progressed on both teams. But yeah, probably my favourite moment was probably Ciara McGeen winning the gold medal in Rome. I was lucky enough to be in the stadium on the night, and it was just incredible. I think definitely sport is kind of meant to be experienced live, I think, and when she won gold that night, it was just incredible, and got to be really close to it as well. And probably in a close second, although not Irish, I think Julian Alfred as well, winning the 100 metres sprint in the Olympics, Paris. It was her first medal for St. Lucia, such a small island in the Caribbean. I think there's only like 180,000 people there. So that was pretty monumental as well. And again, I got to see that live too. So yeah, I think those would probably be the standout moments for me.
I was joking earlier that I think I'm the only person in the entirety of Ireland that didn't make it to the Paris Olympics. I think you're about the third person today who has rubbed it in that you got to go over there, Maeve. But you're right, yeah. I mean, I remember seeing the scenes from St. Lucia whenever she won, and it was incredible. Even though it wasn't our country winning, you still had that kind of small nation feel about it. And we know how important it was. Like, it was our most successful Olympics. And we knew how important that was for us. So you could kind of almost feed off that vibe from them as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine the feeling. Obviously, winning a gold medal for your country is just incredible and a standalone. But to do it for the first time, like, you know, really, I think you could see the emotion even. Yeah. Like you said, herself that night, but also, yeah, the kind of celebrations after too and that. So definitely, I think just athletics in general, kind of, I suppose when there is an Olympics on or European Championships and that, it kind of, I think a lot of it takes over a lot of people who mightn't have an interest in it in the other years, you know, to kind of take an interest. And obviously Rashida is another one to mention too, and you know, she's only 22 versus Ciara who's 32. They're kind of at different ends, I think, of their career as well, so it's definitely really exciting to see kind of what's in store for Rashida Leckie as well in the years to come. I've no doubt that she'll be top of the podium soon as well.
Oh yes, I think we're all watching that one very, very closely. Aisling, what about you? What was a highlight from 2024?
Yeah, I might have to jump on the bandwagon of rubbing in being over at the Olympics now, I'm afraid. So I don't know.
Darn, I was hoping there would be someone today that didn't go to Paris.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to be over at Kelly's fight in Paris when she won the Olympic gold. So I think, you know, as Maeve said there, there's obviously just that extra level of when you get to experience something in person. So that one definitely is is up towards the top of the list for me anyway, just like an incredible experience to get to be over at the Olympics at all. And then obviously to get to see an Irish athlete coming out top of the podium, it makes it extra special, I think, for sure. Obviously, you know, on the gaff front, we'd loads of good games here as well, with Tip winning the league in Camogie. Great to see, you know, a different team get up towards the top, and even Kerry in the ladies football just changing things up a bit. Not to rub it into Maeve there now, obviously, after saying go, it came out the wrong side of two of them. But I guess, you know, from a as neutral as you can be perspective, it's good to see different teams coming out, both in LGFA and Camogie, just to change things up a bit.
Yeah, it feels like the success that came out of the Olympics helped put a greater spotlight on the things that were happening at home, whether that's, you know, the Football League, whether it's the GA, the Camogie. It kind of it elevated everything else around it, which was really good to see, Aisling, because, you know, it's very easy for these events to happen and they're seen as a once-off and we get really excited for 4 weeks and then forget it ever happened. But that doesn't really seem to have been the case at all with Paris and the effect since.
Yeah, I think so. You know, Paris happens and we have all these minority sports that we don't see as much of, and we all become an expert in every other sport that we don't watch for another 3 years for the 6 weeks. So thankfully, I think the energy that it brought has, like you said, maybe translated into the sports that we do know a little bit more about. And I think the female athletes doing as well as they did in Paris has helped the profile of probably both women in sport in Ireland and also of minority sports in general in Ireland. I think it's, you know, shown even on a larger side, kind of from a government perspective and policy perspective, the interest that's there to drive on the opportunities for minority sports and women in sports. So hopefully that energy lasts into 2025 and continue to elevate the profile.
Yeah, if anyone saw me making a face there, it wasn't at what Aisling said, but Manchester United have just gone 1-0 up against Arsenal through Bruno Fernandes. So just in case, Aisling, you thought that I was disagreeing with any of your excellent points there that you were making. Maybe what Aisling says there is very true in terms of making that policy case and bringing attention to things on all different levels. And, you know, I know me and you have talked about this a couple of times in different contexts, but on a football side of things, and the hope that when we did qualify for the World Cup that we'd be able to jump on that, and maybe that hasn't quite happened as much as we'd like, but it does feel like it's happening a bit more in the context of the Olympics, and particularly with sports like athletics and even swimming, where we did see so much success.
Yeah, I think so. And that's the thing. I think success definitely breeds interest in it. You know, makes more people, the general public anyway, take a bit more interest in it. And like I said, we did see it with qualifying for first major tournament. Obviously, you'd hope that that would happen every 2 years in terms of football. But it's definitely, I think it's kind of opened people's eyes as well, just to the quality that is on show across the board. You know, like I said, it's not just, obviously the Olympic sports definitely do take that bit of extra interest, because they're very exciting to watch, I think, in general. Maybe not breakdancing, I don't think that's one I got into that much, but otherwise the majority, I think, you know, they are exciting to watch. And yeah, like Aisling said, the quality is, particularly from the female side, I think, is improving all the time. Obviously the male side of it has been there a lot longer, and their quality is there all the time, but I think definitely, you know, the women's side is definitely progressing along across the board in all sports. And yeah, it's good to see, because I think now it's becoming it, you know, we're talking less about women's football versus men's football. It's just football, or, you know, the same thing in different sports too. And I think that's definitely you know, moving in the right direction for sure.
Definitely. And there's lots of exciting things to look forward to in 2025 as well, which we will get into very shortly. But for the moment, we're going to go to a quick ad break, and then we will be back with Maeve, Aisling, and we will have Alison Miller on the line too. You're very welcome back to Off the Ball. Kathleen McNamee here, taking you through our Nulig Naman special show today. It's still 1-0 between Arsenal and Manchester United. Bruno Fernandes getting the goal there. Newcastle have gone 2-1 up over Bromley. And then in the rugby, Leinster are currently leading La Rochelle 10-6. So I'm joined on the line by Maeve de Burka, Aisling Miller, and now also Alison Miller, to look ahead to the year 2025 for women's sport. Alison, thanks for joining us. I was going to ask, is there an event that you're particularly looking forward to this year? But I suspect I may know the answer coming up towards the end of August, September.
Oh yeah, look, I'd be a fan of all women's sports and I've kind of played them all growing up. But yeah, definitely the Women's Rugby World Cup in England would be what I'd be looking forward to. I think location is obviously very important for women's rugby. Depending on where you have the event, you can have a huge, you know, factor on audiences and how many bums you get on seats. So in England, it's like the ideal place to have it with the success with our team. So, and it's obviously very close to Ireland, so we'll have a great interest in that. And yeah, like with the kind of the rise of the Irish team at the moment and their rate of improvement, you know, it's obviously a huge world event, but from an Irish perspective, be looking forward to see how this team keeps improving, which they are doing.
What would be your hope for this team for this year? Because I think last year there was very obvious progress made, and in a way, I think it came as a bit of surprise to people because we weren't expecting it. But now there is that expectation for this team to push on, and the work that Scott Bamand and his team has done in there to even, I suppose, change the image of that team has been massive over the last couple of months. So what would be your hopes for them for this year?
I think that the Six Nations, definitely, they'll have to finish third. They will, I'd be confident they'll finish third. And then just try and close the gap with England, and they could push France. You know, France are up and down and they're not always consistent, and you know, they can play really well and then they can have poor games, so they can get out of France. But closing the gap with those two is I suppose really important. I know you were saying it was a surprise that the team have improved rapidly. I think to people involved in the game, it's not really. I think when the structures were improved and, you know, you got good coaches and there's players in and things have improved, I think he can see what happens when things are done right, you know. For a long time, I suppose 10 years or more, kind of from that Grand Slam era, 2013, things weren't done right. So, you know, things have improved, the right people. There is now a turn on focus on 15. So just to see the rate of improvement among the team is great. But, and the players, you know, have been there. There's new players, but look, they're a team that did really well in Canada, getting the two wins over New Zealand and the USA. So, and they obviously bet Australia on the way to that as well. So, look, there's great players there. They'll be confident themselves. But just definitely changes in the structures and getting things right. And, you know, our turn to folks in the 15s has definitely improved this team. Obviously, the players, there's great players in there that have obviously improved. There's excellent professional coaches in there now as well. So, it's just all combined. So, yeah, you know, third place in the Six Nations, first and foremost.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because obviously there was a massive focus on the sevens up to the Olympic cycle, and, you know, it probably didn't go the way exactly that they wanted it to be. But now that cycle has ended for another 4 years. It does feel like the attention has very much shifted back onto the 15s in a strong way. And as you're saying, the processes that maybe weren't there before, the setup that wasn't there before, it is, when it comes to closing the gap to the likes of England and France and those setups, what is like a realistic hope, I suppose, for the team for this year in doing that? Or a way of going about it as well, I suppose.
I suppose last year they had a really good Six Nations, but the England game was poor. Look, it's really hard. It's hard to answer that when you're up against a team like England and the structures they have in the Premiership. And they just have, they could field two or three teams of their quality. And so for Ireland, where they've really improved under Beamond from the start, to, I suppose now, is their defence. They're a very difficult team to play against. Teams will find it really, really hard to play against. You know, before, I suppose, his era, the defence was problematic, leaking a lot of tries, but I suppose with their two-man tackle, not to get too technical about it, we don't need to do that, but it's, they're hard to play against in an attack. You know, they're well organized, they're structured, they will keep going. A lot of phases, probably similar enough to Ireland's style with Joe Smith in 2019, you know, multi-phases. But I think the introduction of the Sevens girls before the WXV really helps. They're quality players to bring in. And I think they're in a different position than we were 3 or 4 years ago. Now those girls have had plenty of 15s experience. They've made mistakes. they've kind of got positionally sound in terms of 15s and learn the nuances of the game. So they're not kind of coming in and learning, I don't know, you know, really hard times. Like they have experience. So they've been really positive in that. And I think just competition and within the squad is probably the strongest it has been in years. You know, there's the back row was very competitive. You know, there is a lot of competition in, among the squad, which is brilliant. So they're obviously currently in the middle of their Celtic Cup, so no squad as yet. But I think as well, probably the first time in a long time that the coach is the coach, as in making the decisions. And I think I was impressed when he brought back Clean and Maloney because, you know, to me it said, I'm the boss, I'm in charge, I pick the team, which wasn't there, as in, you know, in years gone by, and you'd question some decisions. So look, all those things are there. Ireland will focus on themselves and they are ambitious. But against England, I think it's, you know, last year, I suppose, kind of one error compounds a lot of errors and they have such danger, you know, in their back three. And, but it's just trying to stick to your own processes and play what's in front of you and like control possession which you when you have. But, you know, ultimately England are such a good team and they are hard to stop. So I haven't really answered your question.
I was like, we went from being optimistic to kind of going down the way to being a bit more optimistic again. So, well,
but I think, just being realistic, I think England are, but what Ireland can do is can be really, they're really hard to play against and their defence is so good and they get bodies off the ground quick. They get, you know, numbers in the line. They have huge line speed, so they can frustrate England. But that's not taken away from England's quality. So it's just having a really sound defence. And then when we do have the ball, looking to use our threats that we do have.
Yeah, but England have had their systems in place a lot longer than we have. And they've had their house in order for a lot longer than we have. So it's not surprising that they are in the position that they are. Maeve, I know there's something we've talked about a couple of times, and specifically after that Wales game where Ireland failed to qualify for the Euros this summer. Sorry to bring it up again. And it's something that I've had conversations with people since as well. And there's a real feeling, and Aisling, you probably be able to speak to this as well, that this is a great year for the GAA to kind of, I don't want to say capitalise on the failure to qualify because it's not about going up against each other. But it feels like, you know, we have the World Cup later on in the year. But in terms of sports that people might play side by side, football, soccer and GAA are quite similar in that sense. And with integration happening as well, obviously that's not all going to happen in the next year, but the process of it happening, it really does feel like an opportunity to build something great this year.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is a lot of positive energy maybe around the LGFA and the Camogie, and maybe now with the failure to qualify, slightly negative energy a little bit, you know, in terms of just the success side of it. And, you know, obviously you're playing the likes of Turkey, Slovenia, Greece in the spring now. And with respect to those countries, I suppose the likes of, you know, France, England, who we were playing this time last year, was they would have created a lot more hype and interest from the general public, like I said, whereas very much the diehard kind of, you know, committed fans rather than just fair weather fans tuning in to the football side of it. So, yeah, definitely, I think it is something that the GAA can capitalise on. And like you said, there's a lot of crossover between girls who would be playing those sports growing up. And, you know, in times gone past, you know, definitely maybe in our generation, you know, a lot of girls would be playing every sport under the sun. And it's not really the case now. Obviously, there is a lot of dual players still out there and a few that do play across codes. But it's I don't think it's as popular maybe as it would have been, particularly at the elite levels now. I feel like players are kind of choosing maybe one sport over the other, or they're limiting their sports to two rather than three or four that a lot of us might have played growing up. So definitely it's something I think, and like you said, integration is going to be a huge factor in all of that.
What is the feeling on the ground with GAA and Camogie, Aisling, at the moment in terms of the potential for this year?
Yeah, I think we can do more, to be honest, would be my short answer to that. Like, I think LGFA did a really good job probably up until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. I remember we went over 50,000 attendance at LGFA finals in Croke Park when Dublin were kind of on their run of being in 3 or 4 in a row, which obviously helps massively with attendance when the finals are played in Croke Park. And I don't think LGFA have kicked on from there. And Camogie similarly got up to kind of mid-30s and haven't kicked on from there. So I think we were doing well then. And then I kind of feel we've probably coasted a little bit in recent years. I don't know if that's because the narrative of integration has come up and there's a feeling that is like, oh, well, things will get better when integration happens. And, you know, things will be more equal when integration happens and the profile of women in the GAA will be better when integration happens. I'm not sure if we're sitting back on that a little bit and just kind of expecting it to improve if and hopefully when that happens. But I do think we can kick on more from where we are. Like, I don't understand how, you know, I think if 5 or 6 years ago when we had 50,000 in Croke Park, you'd have said in 5 years' time, LGFA final still won't have filled Croke Park for a final. You'd have been disappointed with that then. And yet we're not disappointed now year on year when we're not hitting 60 and 70,000 in Croke Park. So I think that we need to be more ambitious, to be honest, with what we're doing and how many we're getting at games, and then pushing on, I guess, with the games during the year as well. Like, there definitely is improvement. I know from a Camogie perspective, RTE showed quarterfinals and semifinals, and obviously we've had the Camogie quarterfinals in Croke Park the last couple of years. So things like that are good steps in the right direction. Again, Camogie quarterfinals were played as doubleheaders with the hurling semifinals this year, which is a great way to do it because it brings in good crowds and good numbers, particularly for the latter half of the Camogie games. But I think things are going well, but I don't think we can wait for the women's national team to not qualify for the World Cup and then say, oh, great, now hopefully people will watch a bit of LGFA and Camogie. You know, I think we can be more ambitious with Gaelic games and hopefully try and promote them in their own right.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting what you're saying there about maybe people resting a little bit on the when integration happens fact, because as it stands, we don't really know when it is going to happen. And you would probably say over the last couple of months, it's been relatively off the table in terms of a conversation point. It doesn't really feel like it's being pushed to the front as this big, important thing that we're doing at the moment. It's all about the new rules and little else, you would probably say.
Yeah. Like, I'll be upfront about it and say, like, I'm concerned about integration. Like, you know, we've been given this deadline of integration will have happened by 2027, but I don't really see a very clear blueprint or timeline on what boxes are going to be ticked between now and then and at what points we're going to meet certain deadlines. And, you know, I think if this was a business or an organization that was making a big change like that, you would expect to see intermittent steps that will be achieved between now and 2027. I think, you know, obviously Mary McAleese chaired the integration committee and they spent a year in observation and made a report which effectively said, yes, we'll integrate, it'll be a hard thing to do, it'll be done by 2027. And we haven't really seen much conversation from GAA, Camogie or LGFA about it apart from that. So I would like to see a lot more conversation about it. I'd like to see a lot more talking points around, as I say, steps that we will be making between now and then, even in respect to things like the charter, obviously, that was brought in for female players last year, which was funded for 1 year. And we're presently looking for funding for it for this year, for 2025. You know, there's no steps to start to integrate things like that through funding with the GAA. So I think that there's a lot that needs to happen for integration to happen. I think from a playing perspective, you know, there's no reason that it can't happen by 2027, but it won't happen if we just sit back and wait for 2027 to roll around and then suddenly realize that we haven't done what needs to be being done in the interim. So I'd like to see a bit more kind of transparency, I guess, around the process that's in place and when we will start to see changes.
Yeah, because you would think it's the sort of thing as well that having players involved or at least knowing what is happening is crucial to it being successful, whether that's on the male side or the female side, because as we've seen before, you do need that support from all quarters and you need that buy-in from all quarters. And I think there's been points in the whole integration process where it doesn't feel like everyone has totally bought in, and that's just going to be a recipe for an absolute disaster at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it'll be difficult for a number of reasons. Every stakeholder going into it is going to have a different list of priorities, a different agenda of what's important to them and what they want fulfilled first. I guess, you know, from a player's perspective, we're going to want basic things like whether it's access to pitches and facilities and training venues and resources and funding and all that sort of stuff. But from a governance perspective, obviously, there'll be a knock on effect with the fact that you've three organizations becoming one, and you know the number of positions that are available there and how they'll be filled and how balance and gender equality will be maintained and that sort of side of it. I think, you know, from a governance standpoint, maybe that side of it can be more complicated, but I'd like to see some steps in the meantime while that's getting sorted out about how players will be treated more equally while that side of it's being worked out. You know, at the very least, I don't know why that side of it can't start to be fulfilled in the next couple of years.
Maeve, we see Aisling there talking about the GA and the importance of the organisation buying in, and Alison talking about the rugby side and how important having all the processes and the background stuff working and set up properly. What would you like to see from the FAI in 2025 in terms of ensuring that, you know, since we're not playing the big name teams or we're not necessarily attracting the big name stars to the Aviva for certain games, to encourage people to keep coming and I suppose encourage people to keep picking up a football and going out, and whether it's into your local club or in your backyard or wherever it might be, what would you like to see from the FAI?
I think maybe even more of an emphasis on the domestic game and trying to kind of create bigger interest in the women's premier division here, because I think definitely like a successful grassroots and women's domestic league will definitely like in time lead as well to the success of the national team. Obviously, at the moment, we rely heavily on the granny rule and bringing in players from abroad. But if we could have as successful a league as the likes of, you know, you just look at Germany, France, the US, the top teams in international football all have really, really strong domestic leagues. So there's definitely been high points. I suppose last year, the average viewership of the for league games in the women's Premier Division increased by 70%, which is huge. Really, it's over, I think, over 33,000 people average attendance or average viewership, you know, watch those games. And given their league games in the domestic league, I think that's really good progress. And definitely TG Carr are doing a lot of work in that regard, you know, in highlighting the games and making them available to a wider audience. So definitely, I think that would be a focus. And continuing, I think, to kind of publicise the national team games, which in fairness they are doing. I think the media department in the FAI is definitely, you know, a shining light in there, because they are kind of constantly trying to promote the game. And I think they are quite successful in that, in the terms of the attendances and that. I mean, I'd imagine a lot of the games will go back to Tala in the spring, because, you know, it's sometimes not financially viable. You're going to need to have at least over 30,000 people at games to make in the Aviva to make it financially sustainable. So I think we will see the games back in Tala, but I think just to keep creating that kind of feel good factor around the team as well, just to keep them in the spotlight, because it is important. I think it's just, you know, when young girls see whatever sport it is on the TV, then that's the ball they want to pick up and go outside, or the field or the track they want to go to. Once they see it on the telly, they're going to try to emulate it then in the back garden, like I said, or down in the local pitch.
Alison, may have mentioned there the hopes of growing the league in Ireland. And I know on a rugby perspective, we're very much always focused on the national side more so than the provincial, or even the few players that go over and play in England. And you see the likes of Ilona Maher going from the States to Bristol and how much excitement that created. And I suppose having that face of the sport is really important. But in terms of the provincial setup here, what can we do to continue, I suppose, the growth of rugby from that level, so that the national team continues to have the sort of players that we need to be competitive in the Six Nations and the Rugby World Cup, and hopefully catch up with your Englands and Frances?
I suppose we don't have a huge player pool, which people often see as a disadvantage, but for me it's an advantage, because you can get to know every single player in the country, really, you know, with the player pool. But currently, obviously, the women's WNTS, you know, where they track players and they have them in their hubs around the country, and they have their individual coaches are coaching them each week, and that's been huge, and that's bringing through young players. Currently, they're in the middle of the Celtic Challenge, which I'm kind of, you know, I wrote down some of the results of the games, like Wolfhounds bet Glasgow 48-7. The Clovers bet Gwalia Lightning 29-7. So for an Irish perspective, we're probably not getting hugely challenged in those Celtic Cup games at the moment. But if you look at the results of the Interpro, which happened in August 2024, they were very tight games, you know, like Munster 29, Ulster 22, Ulster 25, Connacht 25, Munster 31, 21. And the idea of the Celtic Challenge is a great idea, but currently, I suppose, the best players from Wales and Scotland are playing in that English Premiership, as you said. So our two Irish teams, when they go face-to-face, they do have a good competition. It's competitive. But I suppose when most of Scotland and Wales' best players are not playing in this competition, you'd wonder how beneficial it is to the Irish teams play, you know, hammering teams. When you look at the results of the Interpros in August, and they were very close. So the Celtic Cup is a great idea in theory, and it might evolve and it'll probably improve in the years to come when Scotland maybe and Wales don't rely on much as much sending their players to the Premiership. Well, they do it of their own back. They don't send them. But I just wonder would an extended Interpro be beneficial, considering I was actually involved coaching with the Connacht women this year, and they train really intensely for a lot of time just to play three or four matches, and you'd wonder, could that be extended to, because the competition is a very good competition. It's very short, over quick, and they are competitive games, and it does kind of highlight talent. Obviously the Celtic Cup is great because what it does is it gives players an opportunity to play 10 rounds, which is huge, and play games, and you kind of get to track maybe some raw talent, let them develop. Maybe they're not ready this year for Ireland, but in a year or two. So it's great in that sense. Look, it's not perfect. Obviously, the AL has huge work to do. Like, I actually played a league game last year because the club I was involved with were stuck, and I hadn't played rugby in 4 years, and I shouldn't have been able to do that. So, no, it was very tired running around the place. But I don't think it should be...
Shouldn't be that easy to step in.
Well, it wasn't easy, but at the same time, I played the match. So, there's a lot of work to do there, as I said. The national talent squads are great, and they are tracking players and they're developing players, and the Interpro is good. I wonder, could it be extended? There was talk of professionalising the women's provinces. Like in the Celtic Cup at the moment, you're seeing a lot of different players from week to week. The teams change, you know, the Clovers and the Wolfhounds, they do change. You see players coming in that weren't playing last week. So it's given everyone a chance. It's probably given Scott Beamond a chance to see players, but at the same time, if you're winning 48-7, I wonder how much you're really, you know, if the opposition aren't the same, I don't even mean the same level, but if you're beating them that well, I wonder how much he's learning or the players are learning. But at the same time, it's better not playing games, which was kind of happening. But yeah, it's an interesting one. But the AL definitely needs to be improved. Like to see, like the latest results were like, you know, UL Bowes 50, Galwegian 17. There was a 58-3 to Railway Bet Ballincollig. You know, they're very one-sided results. The top four to the bottom four, you know, is huge. So, and I suppose in a way that the fact that Irish women have professionalised is brilliant. It's brilliant. They're based in Dublin, which means then most of the players are playing for Dublin clubs and the teams outside Dublin struggle. So a lot of work to do there to try and get players playing, you know. Like, and there is, like, there's small clubs out there that have brilliant players, and I think sometimes maybe they're not tracked. And they're like, as I said, we don't have a huge player pool, and I think more done to go and kind of see players in smaller clubs, you know, fast-track players, get them into the system. Because, like, that's where I came from, and nobody came looking for me. I didn't make Leinster trials. You know, but I went to Connacht and took the long route, but played for Ireland within a year. So there's often there's often ways around it, but it's kind of get the structures in place. But I'm just interested in the GA talk because I'm actually from a GA house first and foremost, and it's one of the first to play rugby in my house. But like, I was involved with a women's team there that won the All-Ireland Intermediate final there in Croke Park, Ben and Carrington, Ireland. And I'd be very involved in the GA, but I think, like, the benefit of the GA is it's so community-based and everyone is interested in it. As much as, like, I've played rugby, whatever, people are so involved in GA and are so interested. Everyone is. So that's, they have to tap into that. And, you know, integration is interesting, but I don't know if someone needs to kind of nearly force their hand and a few people, like influential people, make it happen. But it's difficult for the clubs, like my home GA club, which I would have played up till 2012, like they couldn't find a coach for the last 2 or 3 years. So there's huge problems kind of even at the, you know, domestic or whatever you call it level, like clubs not being able to find coaches, not being able to get pitches. And it's difficult, you know. But I think they do have to tap into like that community base and that community feeling and drive it from there. But it is interesting because the last time I was at the ladies' finals, Leash ladies were in it. So would have played with some of the girls. That was 2022. But it's really awareness and getting those players out there, knowing their faces and more media awareness. And I don't know how you do that, like player meet and greets. That's obviously draining for players, but you got to get the promotion up and maybe make it a festival, make it a family event. You know, don't charge for kids in the day. Like, if they're trying to make money on it, or are they trying to actually get bums on seats? That's a big question, because if you could get more people at the games and just, you know, not charging for, you know, under 12s, whatever, you know, get all the primary schools a festival of sport that week. And I don't know, like, you know, up for the match, you don't have that for the women, like, you know. You know,
I think it'd be great. I'll put myself out there as a willing host if anyone wants to employ me to do it. Maybe we'll do an off the ball one closer to the time.
You definitely have to tap into the community thing. It is the most, people are most interested in GA, like, as much as, you know, I'm into rugby or athletics or whatever. Like, that's what, you know, gets people together in the community, the GA. And that's the strength. So it's tapping on the strengths, but there's problems underneath. With integration, I don't know how people, you know, have to kind of get the conversation going and force the hand a bit into getting it started, you know.
I think even just locally, I see it, just a local club here used to have separate membership for the boys and the girls. But I know this year now, families with boys and girls can have one membership, like a family membership. So I think there probably is small steps been taken, but obviously we can't see it yet. It's the gradual thing. I know it will take time, but hopefully they can, you know, get it going and that it will be smoother than we think. But yeah, it's definitely, it's like that, it's all coming, everyone coming together, I think, and just trying to row in the same direction.
Maybe, yeah. How do you feel about, oh sorry Alison, go ahead.
No, sorry, I was only going to say, like, the clubs actually seem to be nearly better than at a national level. Like, a lot of the clubs, I know my own club, St Vincent's, are a one club model, and I think more and more we're seeing that where they are. And like, if anything, the clubs are kind of ahead of the national governing bodies in that regard, that like they have a better sense of integration. I know for us in my own club, like the senior camogie team would have equal access to our main pitch, whether it's all weather, whether it's the senior pitch, you know, we've no trouble getting all that sort of stuff. All of that would be very, like, fairly divvied out between teams and spaces made for everyone. But it's nearly like it's being forced on either local county boards, whether it's Dublin GAA having to find space in Parnell Park for the camogie team to play, or whether it's Vincent's having to find equality for the senior camogie team. Like, it's not happening at a national level, and it shouldn't be on the local communities to be the one setting the standard. Like, there should be kind of, whether it's national guidelines, we should be leading from the top. The standard should be being set from the top. So, you know, like, it's great that local communities are doing that, but it shouldn't be falling on them. It nearly shows how bad it is nationally that, you know, local communities are having to go above and beyond what's been expected. And I think as well, on Alison's point with the marketing, I think, like, that's a huge point for female finals for both LGFA and Camogie. I think it's something LGFA were doing really well when Dublin were in back-to-back finals. You know, the attitude that was taken was fill the stand. And like that, are you trying to turn a profit or are you trying to get people in? Because I think we can't have a season-on-season attitude to these things. Like, yes, if I go in with the attitude of I want to make money off the LGFA final in 2025, I'm going to find that hard to do and to fill the stadium at the same time. But if I go in with an attitude of I want to build a game and promote a game that in 5 years' time is going to fill a stadium every time there's a national final on, then you get to a point where this year the priority is just get bums on seats, get people in, go into primary schools, give them tickets for, you know, parents, have free tickets for 10 kids for every adult ticket spot, whatever way you want to promote it. But take an attitude of get numbers in, and then you'll get the coverage when you hit 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 in Croke Park. And as you get the coverage, you get the big companies like Lidl coming in and sponsoring ladies football, and you can make your money back on marketing. And I think AFLW did that very well when they originally started expanding over in Australia. You know, I don't think they turned any profit for the first good few years, but you see the community that they've built behind it. You see the interest in the game and you see them starting to get closer to breaking even and making profit now. So like, I think we need to have a longer term view on how we're marketing and promoting the games. We know we're centuries behind, you know, the male equivalent. So we need to invest into the women's sport with a longer term attitude instead of like being worried about making a profit in a game that we play once, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. And I think it's sometimes frustrating how, whether it's big companies or people coming in looking to do sponsorship, that they don't see that profitability and the marketability that is in women's sport at the moment. You know, Ashing, you mentioned Lidl there, but you even look at, say, the effect of the Paris Olympics and how, you know, Adeleke's name is now one of the global names of sport. And it's just, it's the way we choose to put people forward. You know, we have Katie McCabe, who is one of the top footballers in the world in our ranks. You know, there are plenty of ways that we can harness the people and the players that are in the country and turn them into maybe the stars that they're not necessarily seen as. I think sometimes we forget that as well, that it's not just a case of what people do on the pitch, which is obviously going to attract attention. But also there is an option there to pluck someone and make them the face of your sport and make them the person that's a good spokesperson, that is able to talk about the sport well, who's able to advocate for the sport really well. That side of things, I think, goes a little bit unused sometimes. And I think all sports could do with harnessing that a little bit better, because as we've seen, sportswomen have had to advocate for themselves since the start of time. You know, all these women, and I'm sure you guys are probably all the same, you've always had to speak out and prove your place and prove why you needed access to things, or say, you know, we want that equal treatment. And because of that, that means that there are loads of really good speakers in our sporting ranks, but there are also people who are incredibly passionate when they're putting that across. So I think that's one thing that we could definitely hopefully see a little bit more of in 2025. We're nearly out of time, but one sentence answers, and this is never going to work, but what's the thing you're most excited for in 2025? Alison, you can go first.
Oh, skip me for a minute. I need a minute to
Okay, Maeve.
I mean, I guess it is the Women's Football Euros in Switzerland. Obviously, we'd all like Ireland to be there, but I'm still really looking forward to it. I think just given the fact that the matches will all be on at 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock Irish time, I think there'll still be quite a lot of interest. They'll all be, RT will be covering all the games as well. So I think that's the thing I'm most looking forward to, or the event anyway, I'm definitely looking forward to the most.
Ashling, what are you most looking forward to?
Oh, you're definitely not getting a one-line answer out of me here now. I think like the thing that I'm most interested in is probably the fact that women's sport is doing so well and there is so much to look forward to in that regard. Like that up until a few years ago, probably wouldn't have followed any soccer, but really looking forward to watching the soccer despite the fact that Ireland aren't playing this year. I think it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how Rashida does this year, Mona McSherry as well, off the back of such successful Olympics. But I suppose I do have to give final vote to LGFA and Camogie after saying they're not getting enough coverage. I mentioned earlier there's been like big kind of change up in who's been doing well in them over the last couple of years. And I think, you know, LGFA obviously losing a few more players to AFL again this year, it mixes the whole thing up year on year. It makes it very difficult to know who's going to be dominant and who's going to come out on top. So I think LGFA will be really interesting. And then similarly with Camogie, you know, there's been a lot of change up the last couple of years. Obviously, I'll give a vote to Dublin Camogie here because I have to, but making semi-finals last year for only the second time in 40 odd years, Tip winning the league in Camogie last year, Waterford being in an All-Ireland final the year before that. You know, there's teams coming up to the front in Camogie that I think will change the whole thing up and hopefully keep it interesting anyway.
And Alison, I have 30 seconds, so...
The obvious one would be to say the Women's Rugby World Cup, but that goes without saying. But just Aisling mentioned Rashida's name there. Like, I was involved in it years ago, and to see an Irish sprinter make an Olympic final and coming forward, and she is still a little bit unpolished technical-wise. So I'd love to see her, how she progresses during this year and the next few years, because she is something special. Just to see her progress. Definitely. Because I know her coach, Flo, has a lot of work on for her still, and she's obviously got the raw talent, but to get the technical and nuances of the 400 metre to see her improve would be really, really special.
Yeah, I think we're all hoping for that. And more times of her hanging out with Rihanna as well, so that Rihanna knows what Irish people are like. Alison Miller, Maeve DeBurca and Aisling Maher, thank you very much for joining me. And I hope 2025 is as positive as some of the things that we have discussed today. That was our panel, and you can listen back to all the podcasts wherever you get them. We're going to do a quick ad break and some news, and then I'll be back with Amy Broadhurst.
Off the Ball Daily.